With us, Ellison is an expert on many things, among them numerical solution of convection diffusion equation and numerical linear algebra, in particular the numerical linear algebra aspects of these things, and she's done some really great work. And today she's going to actually enlighten us on Krylov-type solvers for linear systems. So welcome, Ellison.
Thank you. Okay, so thank you very much, Hendry, for the invitation to come here, and thank you to the PIMS people for making it possible. I have been to UBC before, but only as a tourist in the Museum of Anthropology, so it's very nice to be here in an official capacity. So my role at this meeting is really to give a sort of introduction, I think, to those of you who are maybe not so familiar with iterative solvers and preconditioning techniques, namely so that you can get more out of what's coming in the rest of the week. Okay, so this is a relatively basic level, an introduction to these things. The experts are coming on in the afternoons later today and the rest of the week to tell you more detailed about their specific research and so on. In particular, this is such an enormous subject, there's no way in 3 hours we're going to cover it in any detail at all. Primarily, I'm going to be giving you ideas rather than details. Probably the most important slides you'll get in the whole talk are the last two or three, which give you a list of reference books and reference summary papers. There's some very nice books and papers have come out recently that cover these topics with vast range of references. If you're going to do this thing seriously, then that's really will be your starting point. So for now, we want to just get across the ideas of some of these things in an introductory way. It's a very individual subject. There are many different ways of explaining the thing. I'm basically going to be doing it the way that I learned it as a graduate student. So again, very individual. I come from the background of solving PDEs, as Hen said, so everything is kind of biased in that way, the way I think about these things. But hopefully it will cover some useful material. So let me just tell you what we're going to do. This is also the first time I've done one of these PC talks, so I'm a bit sort of miraculous that these slides actually come up here. So here's an overview. We'll start with some motivation of why we're interested in using iterative methods in the first place. And then the main body of the talk is all about the Krylov subspace methods. So the split down into three sort of types, those for symmetric positive definite, symmetric indefinite, and non-symmetric systems. Then I give a brief introduction to the idea of preconditioning, and at the end there's just a little bit of further information with, for example, these references that I mentioned. So we start with some motivation. Why do we care about iterative methods? Well, as I said, I come from the background of solving PDEs, and in fact in my department there's only two of us really that do numerical linear algebra, and my colleagues always laugh because they claim I can't give a seminar without AX equals B on the first slide. This is all I ever talk about. But of course, that's what an awful lot of things in practice boil down to. Linear algebra is extremely important in a lot of practical applications. If you're doing large-scale PDE simulations, for example, just a few applications listed there, it always comes down to linear algebra, and the costs of the linear algebra very often dominate the whole procedure. Okay, it's not the modelling cost, it's not the setting up your finite element equations or whatever, it's actually solving them that can be the dominant cost. So, here are some discretization methods that people may use. I've highlighted finite element because that's most of my experience and mostly what I'll be highlighting in the talk. If we're doing something like a finite element simulation of a very large problem, we set up some grid with local unknowns. Because we have only local connections between the unknowns, then these matrices are going to be very sparse. In other words, they're not going to have very many non-zeros. Okay, so in practice, we've got these very large, if we're doing some realistic 3D problem, very sparse linear systems. So, let me just think of an example. Suppose I have a little model finite element boundary value problem. I can just be solving something as simple as Laplace's equation. I've got a d-dimensional uniform grid with some discretization parameter h with n nodes in each dimension. Okay, so my coefficient matrix is going to be capital N by capital N, where N is either order h squared in 2D or order h cubed in, n squared in 2D or n cubed in 3D. So, for example, if we're using bilinear finite elements, then in two dimensions, you're going to have 9 non-zeros per row of this matrix, and in three dimensions, you're going to have up to 27 non-zeros per row. Okay, so I did a little calculation. If we're on an 8x8x8 grid in three dimensions, then the matrix has over 26,000 entries, but only 4,600 of them are non-zero. Okay, so it's an extremely sparse problem, and for a realistic simulation, a very large matrix. So how are we going to solve these equations? Well, the choice usually before you is, do we use a direct solver or an iterative solver? And of course, direct methods are extremely efficient and extremely accurate in many cases. If we had as large a computer as we needed, then we could solve everything by direct methods, right? It's not an issue. Very efficient for these things. If you have a full matrix problem, they can be extremely good. If you're solving the same matrix problem with lots of different right-hand side vectors, they're very efficient. However, if we're using sparse matrices, then we may get some fill-in with Gaussian elimination. That means we have to change our data structures and causes a large increase in memory. With these direct solvers, node ordering issues are often important. Sometimes if you're doing a three-dimensional irregular finite element problem, faffing about with getting the node ordering right for your solver can be an inconvenience you can live without. And of course, for realistic size, very large problems, storage and CPU restrictions. I mean, this is what really kills them, right? Okay, that there gets to a point where your problem is just too big for a direct solver. So what can we do about it? Well, what about iterative methods? In general, the data structures there are predetermined. There's no fill-in with dynamic putting in extra non-zero unknowns and so on. In general, there's no need for special node ordering in your grid, and they can be efficient for extremely large sparse problems. If you're solving a series of problems, then the last iterate can give you a good starting vector for the next. Say in a time-dependent setup, you're doing different systems one after the other. However, the drawback with iterative methods is that I think it's true to say that there's probably more expertise needed in applying an iterative method in the sense of knowing what method to use and knowing exactly how to use it. And often, particularly for non-symmetric problems, these come with no guarantee of success. So in the commercial world, this is a very big downside from the point of view that they want to guarantee their code will work for their customers. Okay, so these problems, we're getting around these more and more and more commercial codes are including iterative methods as time goes on. Okay, so let's just see for our little model problem, let's compare the work involved in using a direct method. Here is Gaussian elimination with band minimizing node order with the iterative method conjugate gradient. So this is my little Laplace equation problem. If we look at a comparison of the computational work in two and three dimensions, so remember capital N is the size of our matrix. So here are the figures for the amount of work in 2 and 3D. And you'll see the Gaussian elimination part, I've had to split into two here. There's a factorized step and the solve step. And this is really what kills you. You can see here why the advantage of using direct methods when you have many right-hand sides, because you only need to do one factorize and then you're solving over and over again. And here we have the same estimate. Okay. Similarly, with storage, conjugate gradient method comparing favorably for this example with Gaussian elimination. Okay, so that's really my motivation. People really need these things for solving practical problems. So we're going to start now looking at the methods themselves. So part one, I'm going to talk about symmetric positive definite systems. So here it is. I didn't quite get it on slide one, but it always appears. Solving AX equals B. My matrix A is going to be symmetric and positive definite, and it's going to have S distinct and positive eigenvalues. So first of all, we're going to take a very simple look at this matrix. I can write down the minimal polynomial of the matrix, which looks like this. I can now take all of this over the other side, multiply through by A inverse, and divide by this constant here. This constant here in minimal polynomial is the product of the eigenvalues, so we know that that can't be zero, so it's legitimate to divide through here. So what I have is a polynomial form of A inverse. So what does that tell me? Well, if x hat is the exact solution of my linear system, A inverse times B, then I know that x hat must lie in this space, must lie in the span, because if I multiply A inverse by B, I've got B here, AB, and so on, up to A to the S minus 1B. Okay, so this is what's called a, I think I should be saying a Kryloff subspace, but I'm afraid I was taught they were called Kryloff subspaces, and so I will forget, and I'll call them that in this talk, for which I apologize to the memory of a Kryloff. Okay, so we've got our exact solution, and we now know which space it lies in. The question is, how are we going to identify which vector in this space is aligned with the exact solution? So to think about that, I'm going to think about three equivalent problems. Here's my first one, you've already seen it. Want to solve Ax equals b. Now that's equivalent to minimizing this functional phi. Okay, why is that? Well, we want to minimize something, we differentiate it, we set it equal to zero. If I differentiate the function, set it equal to zero, I simply get Ax equals b. Okay, so these two problems have the same solution. Here's my third problem. If I think now of minimizing the A norm of the difference between a vector x and my exact solution, here's the definition of the A norm here. So to see that these problems are equivalent, we expand the A norm of the error, which I have here. It comes out with some fixed quantity plus twice phi. So if we're minimizing phi, then we're minimizing the A norm of the error. Okay, so these three approaches are all going to give us the same solution. And the way I'm going to think about the conjugate gradient method is I'm going to think about problem number two, minimizing the functional to describe the method and identify the exact solution. And I'm going to think about problem number three, minimizing the A norm of the error to look at the convergence analysis. Okay, so I'm going to think of a geometrical approach, if you like, which is I know what space I'm looking in, okay, and now I know I'm looking for the vector in that space that minimizes this functional. So a geometric type method for doing that might, you might start with the method of steepest descents, which is where we're going to start. Okay, so here's the method of steepest descent. Here's my functional at the top. We know from the directional derivative that at a particular point in the function space, this functional phi is going to decrease most rapidly in the direction of what we call the residual rk, which is b minus axk. Okay, so we know that this is where the function decreases most rapidly in that direction. So we're going to set off in that direction. The question is, how far do we go? Well, if we know what direction we're going in, we've now got a one-dimensional minimization problem. Okay, we can go in this direction, and at some point, when we reach the one-dimensional minimum, we can stop, and we'll know we'll be at the minimum point. So here's a one-dimensional minimization problem. I'm going to set off in the direction of rk. I'm going to go a distance alpha k, and you can do the calculus to show that alpha k must take this value. Okay. So because we've set off in the minimizing direction, we're guaranteed that at the next point, we've improved on the value of the functional in terms of minimizing it. Right? Once we've minimized this functional, we're there. We're finished. So I think it's easiest to understand this in terms of pictures. So here's a very simple two-dimensional example, because that's what I can draw. So here's a 2D matrix. And here are the contours of the functional that that represents. So this is phi of A, drawn in the contour plot. So the steepest descent method, I'm going to start with initial guess 0 down here. I'm going to set off in the direction of steepest descent, which is in direction of R, orthogonal to the contour lines here. So I go in this direction. My 1D minimization tells me once I've reached this point, it's the minimum. Because if I start going up the other side of the function, I'll be increasing the value of phi again. Okay, so alpha tells me to stop here. I then say, right, let's look around here. Where's the direction of steepest descent? It's orthogonal to the contours, so it's this direction here. So I head off down here. How far do I go in that direction? Again, a one-dimensional minimum. Same thing, same thing. And now we've reached the minimum of the function down here in four steps. Okay, so that's the idea. It's like a very appropriate for Vancouver, a nice hill-walking, mountain-climbing analogy. It's like trying to find your way down a valley. So that's absolutely fine. Trouble with steepest descents is what happens if we have a nastier function. Okay, so all I've done here is change one entry in my matrix, but I've now got a function with much steeper contours, much steeper sides. So I set off again, steepest descent direction, but what happens is if you have a function whose contours are elongated like this, then you end up wandering back and forth across the valley. Okay, it's clearly not the most efficient way of getting down to the minimum. Right, so can we do any better? Well, how can we change steepest descent? What we're going to do is, instead of setting off in the direction of the residuals, RK, which we know is going to give us the biggest decrease, we're going to choose a different set of search vectors. So here's, now we're getting into the conjugate gradient method. So we're going to choose our search directions, which I've called P here. So the formula for the iterate looks the same, but now we've got free choice for our P's. Before, with steepest descents, P's were equal to the R's, they were prescribed. Now we can choose them. So what we want to do is we want to solve this multi-dimensional minimization problem that says we have to choose the P's. This is just the span of the P's. We have to choose the P's so that we minimize our functional, and at the same time, we have to be able to solve this 1D minimization problem that says how far in that direction we go. So the question is, can we choose the PKs so that we can satisfy both of these minimization problems at the same time? Okay. And not surprisingly, the answer is yes, otherwise I would not be giving you this talk. And the secret is that we choose these vectors, PK, to be A conjugate. Okay, so we introduce the matrix itself into the relationship between the PKs. If they satisfy this A conjugacy property, then it turns out that both the minimization properties on the previous slide are satisfied. So as I said, I'm missing out all the details here. In particular, I've just listed some nice properties that arise from this. Most of these can be proved by induction from the various formula in the CG method. Okay. So if we do this, first of all, our iterate xk minimizes the functional over all x in the span of the direction vectors, which is great, that's what we want. As a result of this, the A norm of the error is also minimized, right? That's, we showed these two problems were equivalent. So if we're minimizing the functional, we're also minimizing the A norm of the error. The residual vectors we get through this process are orthogonal to the Kryloff subspace generated by R0 and A. Okay. Now I should point out a slight change of notation here. Before, when I introduced the Kryloff subspace, I just had B in here. I've just generalized it here to include a non-zero X0, right? The residual is just B minus A X0. If you have a zero starting guess, then R0 and B are equal. So here we've just generalized slightly to include the possibility of a non-zero starting vector. So I'll be using this notation for my Kryloff subspaces from now on. Okay. There are a number of very nice orthogonality properties that appear in this algorithm. As I said, we've chosen these search vectors to be A orthogonal. The search vectors and the residuals are orthogonal, and the residuals themselves are orthogonal. Okay, so all of these properties can be proved from the formulae and fall out nicely. And finally, we have that the residual vectors and the search vectors span the Kryloff subspace. Okay, so we've achieved our aim. We've minimized the functional phi in the Kryloff subspace.
Is this an iterative technique? Or?
Yes. This is an iterative technique. I'll show you right now a sample of what the method might look like. Okay, so we choose some initial guess, we compute our initial R0, and we choose The first search direction is the same as steepest descent, to be P naught, and then we step through. We calculate how far we're going. Our next iterate is the previous one plus alpha times the search direction. We can then update the residual and update the search vectors. And the nice thing about this algorithm is that you'll see it only involves one matrix vector multiply per iteration. The only thing I have to calculate there is A times PK. Okay, so it's extremely cheap. The rest of the time I'm simply doing inner products of these vectors. Okay. Now there are very many different ways of implementing conjugate gradient algorithms. This is just a kind of very simple way that lets you see exactly how it comes about from this steepest descent approach. Okay. Right, so this is basically the algorithm we're going to use. The question we have to ask now is it any good? Okay, how efficient is this thing going to be? So first of all, we have what's called its finite termination property. So here's a reminder of what we've done. We've set up the CG method. It's going to construct iterates in the Krylov subspace that we're interested in. We have the properties that the iterate at the kth step minimizes the error, okay, because it minimizes the functional. The residuals are orthogonal to the Krylov subspace. And PK can be calculated via, I should really say, short-term recurrence here. I just showed you the two-term recurrence version. There's three-term recurrence versions, many different ways of implementing the algorithm. The important thing is it's cheap, right? We're just creating these things from the previous couple of iterates. Here's my theorem. That theorem says the conjugate gradient method is going to find the exact solution, okay, my exact answer in S steps, where S was the number of distinct eigenvalues.
In at most,
yeah. Sure. So here's the proof. We know that the exact solution lies in the Krylov subspace generated with S vectors. We saw that right on the very first slide. And we know that the exact solution lies in the span of the P's, because these are the same space. But X hat, the exact solution, minimizes phi over the Krylov subspace. XS, the conjugate gradient iterate, minimizes phi over the P's, and therefore these must be one and the same thing. Okay, we're minimizing the same thing over the same space, therefore the minimizer must be the same vector. Okay, so X hat's my discrete exact solution. XS is the conjugate gradient vector at S steps, and these things must be the same. Right? So in a sense, this comes back to your question, is it an iterative method? Well, in this sense it's not, because we can get the exact solution in theory. Right? This is all theoretical. Okay. So what does that tell me about my practical example? Well, this time, instead of heading off, the first step, we're going in the same direction as steepest descents, because P naught and R naught are the same. But then here, instead of going in the direction of steepest descents, we construct a search vector which is A orthogonal to this one here. And hey presto, in two steps, we're straight down to the solution. Okay. This must be so by the theory we've just seen, because this matrix has two distinct eigenvalues. And here's the more difficult example. Remember, steepest descents had trouble with this one. Again, the first step is the same, but somehow conjugate gradient knows about the shape of the matrix because of this A conjugacy. It can take that into account, and it heads straight off to the correct solution. Okay. So that's a kind of geometrical way of thinking about it. We're minimizing this functional in a space. Now, I'm going to spend quite a bit of time now talking in more detail about the convergence of the conjugate gradient method. So for that we need to do a little algebra, I guess. So here's a reminder of what we're doing. Our iterates lie in this Krylov subspace. So now let me look at the residual. Okay, it's B minus AXK. So I can substitute for XK a linear combination of the vectors in the Krylov subspace. Right? These are the basis vectors. So I can write xk in this form. And then by multiplying this out, I collect this up. This is my initial residual minus this extra part here. So what we see is that the residual at the kth step is a polynomial in A times R0, right? So here's this polynomial here. Here are the powers of A. And you'll notice one thing about this polynomial is that the constant term in this polynomial must be 1. Okay, all of these have an A in. So the constant term, the term in front of R0, is 1. So the residual can be written as this pk hat, where pk hat is in this set of polynomials of degree k with constant term 1. Right, so where does that leave us in terms of what we're doing? Well, we know that the conjugate gradient iterate at the kth step minimizes the A norm of the error, right? We saw that from our three equivalent problems. So the CG method constructs xk, which minimizes this thing here. So now, if I expand out in terms of the A norm, it turns out that this can just be written as a residual in the A inverse norm. Okay, that's just algebra. Once you've tidied it up into this form, so we see that the CG method finds RK, which minimizes its A inverse norm. So then taking this definition of RK, we see that the CG method constructs a polynomial PK, which minimizes this quantity here. Okay, so we're going to minimize this. It automatically constructs a polynomial which minimizes this expression. So that's not terribly useful. So what we're going to do is expand R0 in terms of the eigenvectors of A. So here's my eigenvector relationship, which I can't reach up there. So the matrix A has got eigenvalues lambda and eigenvectors V. So here's my error. This is what we had on the previous slide. It was pk of A times R0. So now I've put in my expansion of the initial residual. Now multiplying out with the A inverse norm, here's A inverse in here. I get an expression involving pka squared, but because each time I've got pk of A, it's multiplied by the eigenvectors, I can replace the A by the eigenvalues. Okay, so that's using my eigenvalue vector relationship. Every time I have the matrix, I replace it by its eigenvalue. So now, instead of a polynomial in the matrix A, I've got a polynomial in the eigenvalues of A. Okay. Right, so this is now an exact expression for the A norm of the error at each step. However, it's not in a terribly useful form, so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to say, right, what I want to do is I want to extract this polynomial outside from the rest of this stuff. So I can take the polynomial outside by replacing it by its maximum value over all the eigenvalues and making this an inequality here. Okay, so I've just replaced this by its maximum possible value at each step and taken it out the front. Then I can tidy up the rest. This was just my expansion of R0. And here's the A inverse, and this turns into the A inverse norm of R0. Okay. So the crucial line is down the bottom here. What we have shown here is we've shown that the error in the A norm at step k of conjugate gradient method is bounded by this thing here, which is going to be a number, times the initial error. Okay. So this is very precise. It tells us exactly what's going on. And the question now is, what is this expression here? Remember, we've got this conjugate gradient polynomial, which is a minimizing polynomial, which minimizes the maximum value of this polynomial at the eigenvalues. So what we want from this is something useful, right? This is a formula. Does it tell us anything in practice? Right, suppose for a moment that we know everything about our matrix. Okay, so if we know everything about the matrix, then finding the polynomial which minimizes the maximum value at an eigenvalue is an approximation problem. It's a minimax approximation problem. So if we know what all the eigenvalues are, we can solve this minimax approximation problem to find exactly what this number m is. Okay, you've just got a set of points, set of eigenvalues. You want to find the polynomial that minimizes the maximum value at these points. Okay, so I hope you've all done some approximation theory in your numerical courses. This is a very standard example. So is this useful? Well, there's a theorem by Anne Greenbaum that says that this error bound is sharp in the sense that there's always some x naught that you can choose such that this discrete minimax bound is attained. Okay, so this is a useful bound because in some sense it's actually representing what's going on here. Okay, so once again, I'm going to show you some pictures to try and explain this. So let me just, before I go away from the slide, point again to this number here, capital M. So what we're looking for is we're looking to minimize the maximum value of a polynomial at the eigenvalues. So here's my first picture. Let me explain what these pictures are all going to be about. This is a 5x5 matrix. Just got a right-hand side vector B of 1s. 5x5 matrix has got 5 eigenvalues, which are along the axis here. I've represented them with vertical bars so that you can see them, right? But we're really just interested at the points on the x-axis. So the conjugate, suppose we're applying conjugate gradient method to this problem. What it does is it constructs the polynomial at each step which minimizes the maximum value at these eigenvalues. Okay, so this is step k equals 0. In other words, we need a constant polynomial. Remember, we've got a constraint on our polynomial that we must pass through the point 0, 1. Our constant term has to be 1. So a constant polynomial that passes through 0, 1, there it is. It's very boring. It's the polynomial constant 1. Okay. So the error in this case is the maximum distance between one of the eigenvalue points and the polynomial. So in this case, it's 1. It's the same. It's equal at all of these eigenvalues. They all have an error of 1. So the bound m for this polynomial would be 1. Right, so what about step number 1? Well, at step number 1, we're allowed to use a straight line. Okay. Rather than a constant, it still has to pass through the point 0, 1. But now, remember, we're trying to minimize the maximum value at these 5 points. So with a minimax approximation, the maximum value is going to occur at the end points, so this eigenvalue and this eigenvalue, and the maximum error you can see here is about 0.6, the exact value is up there in the caption, 0.6522. Okay, so we've reduced the error constant. Here's my quadratic polynomial, same idea, must always pass through the point 0, 1 because of our constraint. Then it tries to minimize its maximum value at these eigenvalues. Okay, now I'm sure you're getting the gist. Here's my polynomial of degree 3, polynomial of degree 4, and by the time I have a polynomial of degree 5, because I've got 5 distinct eigenvalues, I have enough flexibility to actually pass right through every eigenvalue, and I have 0 error. Okay, so this is the finite termination property again represented in these error polynomials. Okay, so that gives us a little bit of an idea of what's going on with this minimax bound. Of course, there's one rather important flaw with this. That's, I made the throwaway remark, suppose we know all the eigenvalues of our matrix. Now, in general, you will find that this is not the case. So, of course, we need something a little bit more practical. So here's a practical bound. I'm going to suppose now that, okay, I don't know all my eigenvalues, but I know the maximum one and the minimum one. This is a lot more practical. There are ways of estimating these things fairly well from various matrix systems. So what's my approximation problem if I only know the maximum value and the minimum value? Well, it's another classical problem in approximation theory of polynomials. It's a Chebyshev approximation problem. Okay, so here is the polynomial which is the solution to that problem, if you like. It's just a scaled and shifted Chebyshev polynomial. So the Chebyshev polynomial is tk. The scaling here is to ensure that when I put lambda is 0 up here, then I get 1, because we still have to pass through the point 0, 1. Okay. So, what's the maximum value of this polynomial, which went into our constant capital M in the bound? Well, if I substitute that in, I get this here, which I've written with kappa for the condition number, lambda max and lambda min ratio. Okay, so here is the number that goes into the bound when you use Chebyshev approximation, which is based only on lambda max and lambda min. Okay. Right, so why is this more useful than before? Well, it turns out that with the Chebyshev approximation, we can do a little bit of analysis that says, suppose you give me some tolerance epsilon that I want to, you want to say how many iterations will it take before my solution gets within 10 to the minus 6, or the residual gets within 10 to the minus 6. Okay, so you choose some epsilon, then you can do some analysis which shows that the number of iterations required to get down to that level of tolerance is proportional to the square root of the condition number. Okay, so this is a ready reckoning kind of guide. If you know the condition number of your matrix, then using the Chebyshev bound, you see that the number of iterations required is bounded by the square root of the condition number. And this is what people use in general, particularly in engineering disciplines and so on. This is an extremely well-known bound as a rule of thumb for your convergence. So, it's very practical and it's easy to calculate, but is it useful? Well, basically the answer to that is it depends. So, here's a little example which I have cooked up to show you what happens in practice. Okay, so in this picture I've got six different little problems. I should say actually there are copies of the slides down here if anyone, I should have said that at the beginning, I see people are making notes and so on, so if you want to pick up a copy of the slides then...
Why don't we just pass them out?
Yeah, sure. Thanks Jean, sorry I should have said that long ago but... Didn't realize. Yes, you should have said that at the beginning. It's not my responsibility, that's organization. Oh, right. Okay, we'll have a little pause while everyone gets their notes.
The slides are online.
Pardon?
The slides are on the web.
Not anymore, I don't think. I think they've been taken off again, actually. But I don't know. We'll worry about that, yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to turn off the...
You're not turning off the air conditioning, are you?
Oh, no, but
I'm boiling. Oh, I see. The spotlight's down. Sorry. Whoa.
Is that better?
Yes. No.
Oh, this is Elda.
Oh, I see. Okay, so you need to keep Eldad's ones for tomorrow morning. Apparently they were all in the same box. I haven't got those. Yeah, I think Jean has all the ones for today. Well, that's fine.
There are two sets of notes, everybody. At least two sets of notes. The good ones and the bad ones.
That's also the upper one.
So it's all right if we have like two tea breaks, is it? Rather than, because I'm going to stop in probably 10, 15 minutes or so, and then we could have another 20 minute break in between the others or something, rather than a big long break and none.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's totally
okay. That's okay.
You might either choose to have one and then surely, or have two.
Yeah. Okay. We'll see. We just seem to be rattling through it.
Yeah.
Okay, is my beautiful assistant handed out a copy to everyone?
Two copies. The first one says an introduction. Does everybody have an introduction?
No.
Who needs an introduction? Sorry.
Yeah, if you don't recognize the slides, you haven't been paying attention, right? These are Eldads, yeah.
Well, you can say that, you know, you might as well take Eldads.
Sorry, you grabbed the wrong one.
That's okay.
More? Anybody? Okay. We're good.
But these aren't black and white?
These are in black and white, yeah. This is what reminded me, because I thought you might want to get the colours down on the slides for what these ones are, because you may not be able to tell from your black and white versions. Okay, thank you.
But this says there are 74.
Yes, that's right. That's just put there to scare you. I went to a talk once where someone had them like counting down from 74 to 1, because he said it was a much better idea, because then the audience were like, yes, only 5 more to go or whatever. So I resisted the temptation. Right. Okay, well, let's now focus on this picture. So what we have here is I took 6 different matrices. They're all 512 by 512. I ran CG on them with the 0 initial guess, the same random right-hand side. Now, all of these matrices have the same condition number. Okay, and what we have a plot of here is this is the 2 norm of the, a ratio of the RK 2 norm divided by R0 2 norm, and this is the number of iterations it took to get down to a tolerance of 10 to the minus 6. Okay, so according to the Chebyshev bound that we've just looked at, we take the condition number, we take the square root, we get an estimate of how many iterations it's going to take. It has no way of distinguishing between the actual convergence we see in these matrices, because they all have the same condition number. Okay. So what actually are these matrices? Well, if I start from the bottom of the legend, which is this one here, this matrix, it's a 512 by 512 matrix. It has 256 eigenvalues of lambda min, which happens to be 0.06, and it has 256 eigenvalues of lambda max, which is 1.94. Okay, so it's the most extreme case, 2 clusters of eigenvalues, the conjugate gradient method, wham, is finished in 2 iterations. Okay, we saw that from these polynomials we constructed. We only need a quadratic to knock out all of the eigenvalues.
Sorry, did you say that was a symmetric matrix?
Yes. Similarly here, the next one up here, I happen to have done 8 clusters of eigenvalues, so there's 8 clusters of 64 eigenvalues. The clusters are evenly spread between lambda max and lambda min, but conjugate gradients will only require 8 iterations in this case.
So is this why you said that at most we need...
Yes, yeah.
If I have a cluster of same eigenvalues, then...
That's exactly the point. Clusters of eigenvalues are really going to make convergence much faster.
Plus the initial vector. So the space in which the initial vector, even if you have, you know, 512 distinct eigenvalues, but for some reason the initial vector lies in the space of 2 dimensions, then in 2 dimensions, that's the beauty of the conjugate gradient method. The initial vector lies in a p dimensional subspace, p being less than or equal to s, then in p iterations.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, all of these are bounds on convergence in that sense. If you happen to choose the exact solution, right, you're going to converge extremely fast. So it all depends on your initial guess, as Jean said. So all of these are like upper bounds on convergence. What Anne's result showed was with this minimax approximation was there is some starting guess you could be unlucky enough to choose that would result in this number of iterations. Okay, so here, with a 0 initial guess and a random right-hand side, I've tried to generate something that's not specific to the problem, it's just something that you might use in practice. Okay. Right, so these two are artificially clustered eigenvalues. These two curves here, I'll actually say a little bit more about them in a moment. They come from a finite element and a finite difference discretization, which I've artificially given the same extreme eigenvalues. In fact, I guess the condition number is slightly less in the finite element case, but again, I will say more about that in just a moment. up this end of the plot, we have the worst case scenario, if you like. So the two lines here, the blue line, is when the eigenvalues are exactly evenly spaced between lambda max and lambda min. Okay, so in this case, I've just divided up the domain into the requisite number of points. The black line is the absolute worst case that you could possibly have, in the sense that the eigenvalues are at the zeros of the Chebyshev polynomial. So if the eigenvalues are at the zeros of the Chebyshev polynomial, then the Chebyshev bound will hold, right? And it will be exact. Okay, so this is the worst case scenario, if you like, in terms of CG convergence, where the Chebyshev bound is very good at this end. It gives you a good representation of what you might expect. If you have very clustered eigenvalues, the Chebyshev bound does not give you a good representation. You might get much better convergence than that bound would lead you to expect. So this is kind of a trumped up example. Let me go back for a moment to talk about PDE examples. So I'm back to my little model problem on a three-dimensional uniform grid with little n nodes in each dimension. So if I have superscripts R, S, and T, the dimension of the full matrix is going to be capital N, which is little n cubed. So it must have n cubed eigenvalues, and as I cycle through the indices, I get n cubed eigenvalues here for a 7-point finite difference discretization. Okay, so this is just your usual central star in 3D. We can write down the matrix, we can use Fourier analysis. We know that the sine vectors are the eigenvectors of this system, so we can write down the eigenvalues. Okay, and here they are. Similarly, for a 27-point finite element stencil, for the same problem for representing Laplace's equation, then we can do the same thing. We can actually write down analytic formula for the eigenvectors and eigenvalues. And you can see here the difference is that we have products of cosines in this one, where here we just have individual cosines. So that means we can look at convergence on these realistic problems. Okay, it's only Laplace's equation, but it's not just something I've cooked up in MATLAB to illustrate this particular point. So, what do we get? Well, here are the eigenvalues for the 7-point finite difference stencil. So it's the same setup as before. They are represented by these green bars. And here's the Chebyshev polynomial. So as far as it's concerned, it's only been told the value of lambda max and lambda min. It tries to minimize the maximum value at these points, and it equi-oscillates between them, bearing in mind it still has to go through the point 0,1, which isn't on this plot, it's up there somewhere. Okay, so the rest of these eigenvalues might as well not be there for this plot. The Chebyshev polynomial only knows about lambda max and lambda min, and equi-oscillates in between them. And the error is given in this case, again, at the minimum and maximum eigenvalues, and the error is about 0.56, or there it is in the caption. Right, so that's if we only know lambda max and lambda min. What if I now give the approximation problem all the information about the inside eigenvalues? Okay, so here's the minimax polynomial for the same problem. So it's not quite a case of there's a prize for anyone who can spot the difference, but you can see that these things are not so far apart, right? In fact, the difference is that there's a very small gap at the bottom of the spectrum here and at the top here, and so there's a tiny little overshoot by the minimax polynomial, which you don't see from the Chebyshev. Okay, so this is not quite equi-oscillating, because it knows that there's a little gap here and it's using that information. But overall, there's not exactly much difference between these pictures. So in this case, using the Chebyshev bound would give you a very good representation of what's going to happen in practice. What about the finite element stencil? Well, it turns out that because of these products of cosines and so on that appear in the eigenvalue spectrum, then the eigenvalues in this case are much more clustered. These are plotted on the same horizontal scale as the finite difference one. So first of all, you see, I mentioned before, there is a small reduction in the condition number because the largest eigenvalue is not quite so large. But there are also many more gaps in the spectrum down the bottom here. The Chebyshev polynomial, however, doesn't know that. It only knows what lambda max and lambda min are, so it tries to fit through those, and it equioscillates in between them. So in fact, remember, we're interested in the value of this polynomial at the eigenvalues. So if you think of this eigenvalue here, for example, the value of the polynomial is going to be very large. In fact, it's going to be off the graph. Okay, I've done this on a vertical scale. This only goes up to 2.5 times 10 to the minus 3. The actual error, you can see at the top there, is nearly 0.4 times 10 to the minus 2. Okay, so the Chebyshev polynomial only knows lambda max and lambda min. So what happens if it knows all the eigenvalues in between? Well, here's the minimax polynomial for the same problem. And essentially, it's what it does is it makes use of the gaps in the spectrum to get its wiggling out of the way, if you like. Okay, it's got to do some oscillation between the eigenvalues. The important thing is we're only interested in the value of the polynomial at the eigenvalues. It doesn't matter what it does in the gaps, right? So the fact that this is off the screen here, who cares? There's no eigenvalue in that gap. At the actual eigenvalues, the size of the polynomial is restricted, and it's much smaller than in the Chebyshev case. Okay. In fact, yeah, okay. I think that should be times 10 to minus 3 in that caption now that I see it, because this is 10 to minus 3 on the scale, and we should be up here somewhere, right? I'm not sure. Anyway, so you get the idea. The Chebyshev bound can be extremely useful because it's practical. You can do this only on knowledge of lambda max and lambda min. You can usually get a good idea of these in practice. But you have to bear in mind that it doesn't always tell the story. Okay, people bandy about and say, oh yes, I must get my condition number down. If you've got two eigenvalues, then your matrix, your CG method's going to converge in two iterations. Okay, so that's just something to bear in mind.
Well, how do you envision using these bounds?
Well, if you want to get an idea of how many iterations you need, for example. Okay, whether it's going to be practical, whether it's going to be better than doing a direct solve or whatever.
You might do things dynamically as you're solving the system. You might get some better bounds.
Yeah, sure, that's right. I mean, and you might be able to use them in terms of your convergence criteria and things like this, that you're adaptively, as you go through, deciding how to change your method.
Understand, if you have eigenvalues within a radius of epsilon or whatever, there is clustering, but they're not quite...
Yeah, I mean, these are all sort of simplified cases. And, well, particularly the cooked-up example, I deliberately made them distinct eigenvalues. In practice, I mean, this is more realistic, right? You can see there are clusters here, so they've had some effect. They haven't... There's no way until we get to a very high-degree polynomial we're actually knocking these things out. Okay? It's just having them clustered together is going to reduce the error on that particular cluster. Uh-huh. So, what does this tell us about using the conjugate gradient method in practice? Well, you've seen here that there's a lot of very specific theory on how the method will behave. The one thing I haven't mentioned is, of course, is any of this like real-life computing. So, what about the CG method in practice? Well, we've seen we have the advantages, only involves matrix vector and dot product, which is nice, and we have this theoretical property that the exact solution is obtained in, and I've got my at most in this time, I'm glad to see, S iterations for the number of distinct eigenvalues. But there's two major problems with this. First of all, I might have a problem with, you know, 100,000 distinct eigenvalues. Well, it doesn't mean I want to take 100,000 iterations to solve it, right? Okay, so S itself might be too large to be of any use. And secondly, we have the problem that in practice, rounding error means that theoretical properties that we've seen so nicely here are sometimes lost. Okay, so in fact, this led to a very slow take-up in the conjugate gradient method, if you like. It was proposed in 1952, But people try to use it as a direct method, and they try to use it in comparison with Gaussian elimination that said, right, we take S steps, we're going to get the exact solution. Then particularly then, there weren't sophisticated computers or anything, so they tried this, and in practice they found it didn't work. It didn't give you the exact solution because rounding error came in and it was causing difficulties. And so they said, all right, well, this is rubbish. Okay, this method is no good, we don't want it. And I think it was about 20 years, right? Was it 1971 when John Reed came along and proposed it as an iterative procedure and said, well, let's not take S steps, let's just take some steps and see if we can get close enough to the exact solution, that the method had a revival.
Engineers had actually needed something to solve problems which didn't have, you know, proper data, et cetera.
Yeah.
And they sort of needed it, they came back to it, and they used it. So then John Reed,
I guess, yeah, he was the one who kind of publicized it in the numerical community. And there's a very nice paper by Jean and Diane O'Leary about the history of the conjugate gradient method, right? Is that 1989 or thereabouts? Yeah, it's referred to in all the books anyway that explains exactly how this came about. But it, I mean, it's quite remarkable because it really was not used very much for that period of time. And then it was recently named as in the top 10 algorithms of the century, right? So it kind of caught up very late in the century in terms of becoming a very useful method. Hi.
Can I just make a remark?
Sure.
This is something David Young told me. David Young was there back in the 50s working on iterative methods, and they were working on SOR, and they didn't want to use conjugate gradients either because it took up too much memory. In those days, right, the computers had so little memory that you couldn't afford to save four or five vectors. And SOR means you only have to store one vector.
Right.
So conjugate gradients were rejected on the memory grounds because of the nature of the computers at that time.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So it really had a good few problems starting off as a method, but then once it kicked in, it became extremely popular. And basically, one of the main reasons for that is, how can we get around some of these difficulties? Well, we can try and reduce the number of conjugate gradient steps required by applying preconditioning. Okay, so the idea of preconditioning to any iterative method is basically to try and get faster convergence. But I say more later here, and I suspect this is probably a good place to stop for our first cup of coffee. We'll have a little bit of a break and come back. That's okay, Hen? Yeah?